This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Sam Monroe Stein Institute for Research on Aging's monthly public lecture series. For those of you I haven't had the chance to meet yet, my name is Danielle Glorioso, and I'm the executive director of the Stein Institute. For those of you new to us, the Stein Institute is committed to advancing lifelong health and well-being through research, training, and community outreach. And this lecture series is an example of the community outreach that we've been doing at the Stein Institute for over 30 years now. We've been providing quality lectures to the community for free with the idea that we want to get exciting advances that are happening in the field of aging to the community. So we're just delighted to have you, and we're delighted that we've had the support of the community to help us promote this over the last 30 years. So for those of you new to us, we have a website, aging.ucsd.edu, and you can find out more about the research, training that we're doing. We also have a monthly newsletter that is for free, and you can sign up on our website as well. And also, you can donate through our website, and your donation goes to support events like this, where we can promote to the community for free. So it really is my honor to introduce our speaker tonight. Joe Ma is Associate Professor of Clinical Pharmacy at Skagg School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences, and he's a longtime friend and supporter of the Stein Institute. He's a wonderful mentor to our trainees in our summer research programs, and he's actively involved in recruiting pharmacists into our aging programs. His research interests are in examining the methods to evaluate drug-to-drug interactions and pain medications. His clinical practice is pain and palliative care in an outpatient multidisciplinary clinic at UC San Diego Health System. Under a collaborative practice model, Dr. Ma sees patients and is able to start, stop, or modify therapy to treat symptoms and side effects of the disease and its treatment. He has a wonderful talk for you tonight. Please join me in welcoming Joe Ma.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to be this evening, and what I'm going to be talking about is, as the title refers to, how to manage your medications. So I think when I was thinking about what to talk about, managing your medications can be a laundry list of questions, and it can be sometimes complicated, but other times it can be straightforward, and a lot of it depends on the situation you're in, which disease states you have, how many medications you're on. So we're going to highlight the many, many aspects that are involved in managing your medications, but we're going to pay specific attention to medication non-adherence. And the reason for that is that there is evidence out there that in the older adult, medication non-adherence is probably one of the main reasons in terms of the lack of adherence, or what I would call maybe the difficulty in managing his or her medications. So we'll highlight the risk factors and try to conceptualize that with a case MW. And then we'll go into a little bit more detail in terms of, well, why is this happening? What are the reasons for non-adherence? And we'll highlight the evidence that's out there, the data that's published, and then we'll revisit the case that I've talked about earlier in an effort to conceptualize some of the important topics. And then we'll go into a little bit more granularity or a specific aspect of non-adherence called intentional non-adherence that in the older adult can be as high as 86%. So it's pretty high. And then lastly, medication appropriateness. I think one thing that I really thought about for this presentation was how to provide you guys information that you can take with you when you go to your next doctor's appointment or when you're in a situation where you may be going to a pharmacy and wanting to know, well, what am I looking for? What's this drug for? What are the side effects? So providing information in terms of medication appropriateness, specifically something called the Beers criteria, which we'll highlight later. So specific learning objectives are for this talk is to state at least two risk factors for medication non-adherence, state reasons for medication non-adherence, to provide at least one intervention for a patient-specific reason for non-adherence, and then lastly, as this relates again to medication appropriateness, stating at least three drug classes that are potentially, and that's the key word. As we'll get into later, we'll see that it's not absolute, but potentially inappropriate medications for use in the older adult. So These are questions that I often get asked when I'm in clinic in terms of managing your medicines. I get these from patients, I get these from caregivers, I get these from loved ones. And it revolves around many things when it comes to managing your medicines. So the first one, is this working? Is it working for me? Is it effective? There are other aspects of medication taking behaviors that are also, I often get asked, which is, what time do I take it? Is it with or without food? Is it something I can take at the same time with another medicine I'm taking? Because we're always worried about, you know, the potential for an interaction if you take one drug at the same time as another drug. Am I experiencing a side effect due to the medication? Cost is a significant issue. What's my copay? Does my insurance cover it? Is it a formulary? So you can see this list of questions can be quite lengthy and exhaustive. One thing that we often see in the older adult is this issue of medication overuse as well as underuse. And we'll highlight some of the data that's published with regards to that in the older adult a little bit later in the talk. But that's something that is often brought up as a point of discussion. Did I remember to take my medication? Is this the right dose? And then lastly, am I taking the medication correctly? So this can, at face value, look stressful. I can't imagine trying to answer all these in one sitting, and that's not the goal. The thing that really I want to bring home today for this talk is, when managing your medications, is realizing there are people here to help, and that it's not something that can be done all by yourself. And lastly, there are resources out there that you can use that can empower you to have knowledge in terms of what you're taking and why you're taking them. So what do we know about medication non-adherence in the older adult? So I think the best way to bring concepts to front is with the case. So here's a case. This is patient MW. He is a 79-year-old Caucasian male. With regards to his medical history, he's had a heart attack about 9 years ago, high blood pressure or hypertension, diabetes, and COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. His wife died about 2 years ago. He's been retired for about 19 years. He was a teacher, and he's currently on a fixed monthly income. He lives alone, but he's independent and able to maintain activities of daily living, or ADLs. Now, with regards to his medicines, there are a lot here. So if I can do my counting, he's on 8 medicines here. So baby aspirin is something one takes if they've had a history of a heart attack. He's on at least 3 different medicines for his blood pressure. So captopril, metoprolol, and furosemide. These are 3 drugs that work differently in the body that, again, are primarily for this patient case being used to treat hypertension. Chlorcon is a potassium supplement. So maybe some of you are, these drug names sound familiar because you're probably on it or you know someone that's on it. But often individuals who are on furosemide will need a potassium supplement called Chlorcon. He's also on a couple medicines for diabetes, and they're listed here, metformin and glipizide. And then lastly, for his COPD, he's on an inhaler, and that's listed here with regards to albuterol. So what's the data? What's known? What are the risk factors for medication non-adherence? Well, as you age, medication non-adherence increases. And there's actually some data to suggest a cutoff of about 75 years where your risk is highest. So those individuals that are older than 75 have a higher risk of medication non-adherence than those that are 66 to 74, as well as those that are younger as well. Social history. I put a question mark because there's some data to suggest that those that have poor or little social support, meaning they're living on their own or they don't have a caretaker, rates of medication non-adherence are higher. So that's also a risk factor. The role of multiple physicians, doctors, providers, specialists, that's pretty clear. The more providers or specialists that you have, the higher the risk of medication non-adherence, the higher the risk of medication errors. It's an unfortunate circumstance, but it does happen. And I do have some data to present later in terms of what can you do. I don't want to paint a bleak picture here, but it is something where there is the ability where you can minimize that risk by, empowering yourself, knowing what you're taking, and having a medication list. Risk factors as it relates to medications themselves. We know that the more medicines you're on, the higher the risk for non-adherence. And there's some data to suggest that if you're on more than five, you have the greatest non-adherence risk. The complexity of the medication regimen. So one example is warfarin, also known as Coumadin. Maybe some of you are aware of it or not. This is a unique medication in terms of how you take it. It can vary where, for some individuals, you take this differently each day, or you may take it differently each week. Dose adjustments constantly occur because you're essentially dosing to a specific value or a laboratory value where blood testing is often done to look at, to examine that lab value. And it's notorious. I call it a dirty drug in some ways. It's notorious in that it is known to cause a large number of drug-drug interactions as well as drug-food interactions, so something we don't think about a lot, drug-food interactions with warfarin or Coumadin. So this figure is just an example of how complex it can be for some individuals or some patients who are on Coumadin, which is the same as warfarin. And what I want to break down is, for this example, what we see here is we see three different doses or dosing strengths of Coumadin. And what we can see here is just a calendar. So Sunday all the way through Saturday. And what I find really interesting and potentially really confusing is you can see how almost each day your dose differs. So anywhere from 2 milligrams one day to 3 to 4. I can't imagine if these were all the same color. Good luck. So at least there's some color differentiation. But again, if you didn't have this calendar, it's very difficult to know, you know, what you're taking. Even on some days, you see here, they're not taking any Coumadin or any warfarin at all. So again, warfarin is a nice example, or an example, I should say, where the complexity of how you take it, how much you take each day can vary, and that is a known risk factor for non-adherence. What we also know is that the frequency, so how often you take the medicine. Do I take it once a day? Do I take it twice a day? 3 times a day, 4 times a day. So this was a paper that was published in JAMA back in 1989 that looked at the relationship between compliance and the frequency of a medication. And there's some pretty drastic numbers. So what we see here is in this table is that there were several different types of medications where the frequency was once a day, twice a day, 3 times a day, 4 times a day. And what we see here are the compliance rates. And as we go down here, go down in this column, we see that our compliance rate really, really drops off when we're taking medicines 3 to 4 times a day. This column here just gives you a range, but the take-home message is the same. If I'm taking a medicine 3 or 4 times a day, even twice a day, the data suggests that you're more likely to be non-compliant than if you were to take a medicine once a day. So if we're thinking about our case and what we want to do, what are some of the facts and what is the scope of the problem? And what I mean by that is there is also data to suggest that what we think patients are taking with what they're actually taking, they don't match. They're way off. And so what we have here is that there are discrepancies that range 30 to 66% of prescribed medications versus actual in the older adult. So there was a study that was done where these were done in older adults where after they were discharged from the hospital for a specific hospitalization, that 2 days after discharge, they asked these older adults. And what they found was that about 64% were taking at least one medication that was not ordered at discharge. 73 did not take at least one medication as directed. And then about a third were not taking at least one medication prescribed at discharge. So they weren't even taking it at all, even though they were discharged, saying you need to start this when you go home. What we also know in terms of some of the data is that prescribing providers are unaware of the medications their patients are taking. So that is unfortunate, but the data is out there to suggest this. And specifically, what I've seen in the literature, over-the-counter and herbal, so herbal I would also put as vitamins, supplements, supplement use, commonly not asked at physician visits. And this is what is concerning is that the frequency of over-the-counter OTC use among the older adults is anywhere from 32 to 86%. So if we have a large percentage of our older adult population using over-the-counter agents, using herbals, using supplements, yet we're not asking about it, there's a disconnect there. So this is just repopping the case back up that I presented earlier. So again, I just wanted to highlight MW. He's 79 years old. He has a medical history of a heart attack in the past, high blood pressure, diabetes. He lives alone. He's on a fixed monthly income. And he's on eight different medicines. So knowing what we talked about earlier about known risk factors for medication non-compliance, let's look at specific risk factors for the patient case. So we know Mr. Woods is 79 years old. So we know that if you're older than 75, your risk is higher. So right away, Mr. Wood, based on his age, will have a higher risk for non-adherence. What's his current living situation? If you may or may not recall, he lives alone. His wife passed away a couple years ago. So there is concern. It didn't allude to in the case, but more likely than not, he may not have a caretaker. So another risk factor where, again, that I would say lack of appropriate social support to be a caregiver or to help in taking medicines is not there for him. So that's something of concern for MW. I would imagine, although it's not really detailed in the case, he's probably going to have several physicians or several doctors. Based on the fact he's probably got a primary care provider or PCP, he's had a past history of a heart attack and high blood pressure, so more likely than not, we'll probably have a specialist or cardiologist. And also for his diabetes, he'll probably have an endocrinologist. And so what we know is polyphysician is what I like to call is another known risk factor. So he has that. He's on eight medicines. So we know if you're on more than five, your risk is highest. So he's got that as another risk factor. Frequency of medication use. I didn't really highlight it, but there was one medicine called Captopril that it was being taken four times a day. So as we saw earlier in that data, if you take a medicine four times a day, the rate of being compliant is going to be quite low. And then lastly, medication regimen complexity, potassium supplements in lieu of furosemide use. The reason where I think this can be difficult is there are several potassium supplements. They have different names. They come in different, I call this pharmacy speak, milliequivalents, milligrams, so it can cause confusion. In terms of even though they serve the same purpose in terms of replacing potassium, they have a slightly different art to how we speak it. So what can MW do to minimize his risk? So I think one thing that you'll hear as a common theme throughout the discussion is keep an updated list of medicines. And that includes not only those that are being prescribed, but ones that you're taking over the counter, those that also include herbals, supplements, multivitamins, things you may buy at the GNC store. So keeping a very complete list. Because as we saw earlier, unfortunately, for some providers, they don't even ask about it. So if they don't ask, they don't know. Attempt to obtain medications from a single pharmacy. Ideally, we'd love to have it where pharmacies are talking to each other, where their medication lists are shared, but they're not. So if you get medication from, let's say, a Target pharmacy, and then the next day you're going to a Walgreens pharmacy, unfortunately, those systems don't talk to each other. So the profile of the medicines that Target has on your file may be different from what Walgreens or the other pharmacy has on their file. So be wary. In terms of if MW is indeed getting care from multiple physicians, keeping them up to date. One thing that's nice is the utilization or the use of the electronic medical record. So here at UCSD, if you have all of your care done here, there's Epic, which is our electronic medical system, so it's shared. So the physician, let's say you see a physician at Hillcrest and you see another specialist here at Thornton or in La Jolla, they can see what you're on based on a shared electronic medical record. It's being done at Kaiser here, Sharp as well, so it's being done locally. So the question I got is, do our records keep track of herbals and supplements? Okay. So yes, we can, but it needs to be asked by that provider, what are you taking? And then what I do in that situation is I would document it. I can write it down as a historical medicine for sake of completeness. So we've talked about the data in terms of the known risk factors for medication non-adherence. Now let's kind of progress a little bit more in terms of what are the reasons behind medication non-adherence, specifically in the older adult. So we're going to first talk about medication knowledge as one reason for non-adherence. So when we talk about medication knowledge, one aspect relates to what's the name of the drug and what am I using it for? What we know is that in about half of older adults, they did a pretty neat, in these studies, they did essentially a survey. They asked, all right, do you know what you're on? Do you know the name of the drug? And do you know the reason you're taking it? So from this research, about half knew the name of the drug and knew why they're taking it. But there's a catch. But less than 25% knew common side effects of the drugs. So I would say, you know, we're doing good in terms of we know the name, we know why we're taking it, but what are the common side effects to look out for? We can do a little bit better. Now, when they looked in older adults who had a specific disease state, specifically heart failure, about 64% of patients were able to identify which medications were for heart failure. But again, if we think about that, 64%, not good, not great. So that's where the data is with that. This, it also can carry over to the use of devices. So what we mean by devices, I would say, are inhalers. So as we saw in the case earlier, MW is taking albuterol for a COPD, so that's an inhaler. We know that with regard to the use of devices such as inhalers, older adults have insufficient knowledge of the technique. So a lot of times you may think you're using it, but if you don't know how to use it, you may not be getting the full effect of the drug. So what are some things that one can do, or what are some interventions? What are some things that are trying to be done to help minimize or at least improve medication knowledge? One is using large letters or bullet or list format. So I, for full disclosure, I don't work for Target. I never have. But one thing they do really neat, and the reason I know this is my mom keeps reminding me, is that they have large labels for their medicine bottles. So it's easier to read for her. So I think that's something where, again, having it where you can, it's legible is important. Drug name, how to take it, special instructions. Again, having this, I often see this being done in most retail pharmacies where they give you essentially something on a piece of paper. But I think what I see a potential disconnect is that paper can be 5 pages, can be like a font size, very small, and there really isn't that discussion of, well, if do I read everything? Do I look out for everything on that packet? Or really, what's the most salient? What do I need to know? What's the most important? And often that can be missed if one is so stuck on trying to read everything in that information that's being given to you. So other things to think about, consider medication schedules or charts, like a calendar. And lastly, redundancy is best. I think repeating, showing that, you know, I often, in patients I see in clinic, when they're on inhalers, I ask them, so show me how you take the inhaler, and I, you know, teach me, if you will. And just practice. So practice is something that we often recommend. But verbalizing, as well as writing, again, the drug name, how to take it, special instructions, and side effects at subsequent visits. So going back to our case MW, with regards to medication knowledge, does MW know which medications are used for his hypertension, his diabetes, his COPD? Is he aware of when to call his doctor if he's experiencing a side effect? We didn't see it in terms of in the example, but asking, is he on any over-the-counter or herbal or supplements? And then asking, show me your inhaler technique. You've been on albuterol now for COPD. Show me how you use it. So the comment, I agree. So the comment that was made was in the previous slide, one needs to know which physician to call in the event of you're having a side effect. Sometimes in the heat of the moment, there's that sense of anxiety. Oh my gosh, I'm getting a headache or getting lightheaded. I think the biggest thing is, you know, call a doctor. So it could be your primary care, it can be your, you know, cardiologist, but call someone. Because I think the biggest thing that I worry about is those that don't call, thinking, oh, this will go away. But if it hasn't, then being aware that I need to call someone. So physical ability is what we'll highlight next. So there is evidence, strong evidence, linking non-adherence to poor vision, low manual dexterity, and poor health literacy. So in a study of community-based older adults, they observed behaviors in terms of medication consumption. They found that about 28% left the medication bottle open and or did not keep their medication bottles closed. Almost half self-reported to having poor eyesight or the inability to read English or small writing on the medication label. So what are some things or some interventions to consider? Again, this doesn't mean you have to do everything by, you know, every little thing that's stated here, but things to consider that may be helpful for you. Use of a pill box, and if you have a caregiver or family member to help complete that or fill the pill box. Having a calendar with the pill box. For those that may have trouble opening those child-proof containers, there is the ability for non-child-proof containers and, in some cases, the potential for unit dose packs or single dose packs. Some instances you may need to be able, or you may be required or needed to break or split your tablet. So just knowing which ones are easier to split, which ones are not. Large print labels and then language translation. You know, being in the San Diego area, we do have a pretty large population of Spanish speaking only. And so having that ability where the pharmacy can translate into a language an individual can understand is important. Cognitive capacity. So we have evidence linking non-adherence to poor cognition, to forgetting. Specifically, decreased cognitive function is associated with both, I would call, over-adherence and under-adherence. So what I mean by that is over-adherence is you're taking, supposed to take a once-daily medication, but you're taking it more than once a day. The opposite is under-adherence, where it's a dose omission, or you're forgetting to take a dose, or you're not taking the dose. We know in the older adult, under-adherence, or the rate or prevalence of under-adherence is much higher compared to over-adherence. So in terms of what one can do to help remember medication taking is memory cues. So clock time or an alarm, a meal time maybe, so you're associating medication-taking behavior with a routine, in essence. If you, let's say every morning you eat a breakfast, you know, bowl of cereal or an orange or an apple, if you do that every morning, trying to integrate medication behavior into a normal daily routine. If more support is needed, there are other memory-enhanced methods, such as a calendar. There's actually reminders. I know there's I've seen patients do this when they come to clinic. They love showing me, guess what I've got on my cell phone? I've got an alarm, and I've got my diary, and they show. So those that are those tech-savvy ones, those tech-savvy patients are really so attached to their cell phones, will often put some kind of reminder on their cell phone. And then also the potential to discuss dose simplification with providers. So revisiting the case of MW, during a conversation, he tells you that he often forgets to take his blood pressure medications since he needs to take them all the time. And another medication makes me sleepy after he takes it. He's also unsure of why he needs to take a potassium supplement since he eats a lot of bananas. So bananas do have potassium in it. I'm eating three bananas a day. You know, it's great for general health, but really the take-home message is the potassium one needs to supplement with a potassium supplement is going to be more than what you're going to be getting from consuming bananas. So if we think about the reasons for non-adherence that we highlighted earlier, let's bring it back to the case, bring it back to MW, and see. There could be the potential, if he has some limitations with regards to his physical ability, maybe thinking about non-childproof containers, with regards to observing and also maybe critiquing, if needed, proper inhaler technique regarding his albuterol. If there is the potential where he has trouble seeing the small print on labels, to consider a larger font, and if he's has a limitation with regards to his cognitive capacity, he can use memory cues that we highlighted earlier. Clock time, associating it with a daily ritual, a meal time, whatnot. With regards to dose simplification, a couple of things that one can consider. One is, I alluded to this earlier, captopril is something that is used for high blood pressure. It's also used for those that are experiencing a heart attack. So what can happen is that captopril is in a class of drugs known as ACE inhibitors. So there are at least 15 different types of ACE inhibitors that basically do the same thing as captopril, but you only need to take it once a day. So simplification. So maybe there's the potential where MW can switch to another drug that is in the same class as captopril, but only need to take it once a day. Sedation, I would say, in this, for purposes of the case, and this is quite common, is from metoprolol. One could consider, there is metoprolol in a branded name called Toprol XL, that you can take it once a day and you take it at bedtime. So if you're getting sleepy, you take it at bedtime, it helps you go to sleep. I think, you know, that'll work, rather than taking the metoprolol in the morning or during the day, during the waking hours. Check the potassium. So if MW's potassium is normal, there could be consideration to stop the Chlorcon or the potassium supplement. If it is low, we would want to educate him that bananas may not contain enough potassium for what his body needs. And then one thing is another way of consolidating is Metaglip. In essence, Metaglip is a medicine where it's one tablet, but it combines metformin and glipizide into one tablet. So rather than taking two different pills, he can potentially take one, but it has both in it. So let's talk about another reason, intentional non-adherence. And we have a different case. So the different case is LL, so 93-year-old female. She was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2014. She's had radiation and chemotherapy, which were done last year. She enjoys drinking tea, sewing, light gardening, doing laundry. So that tells me already she seems to be independent, probably able to maintain her activities of daily living. She's getting out and she's running errands, keeping herself busy. This isn't a complete list, but in patients we see that have cancer, often we'll be treating cancer-related pain. And so these medications, morphine, CR, which essentially is a long-acting version of morphine, it's indicated to take twice a day or every 12 hours. So this is by mouth every 12 hours. And she misses doses due to nausea and vomiting. There is also a short-acting morphine, which is listed here, by mouth every 4 hours as needed. And she's averaging about 2 or 4 doses a day. But one thing that is important for this case is she only takes it where pain is excruciating. So 10 out of 10 means you've got excruciating pain, and it's so severe that she's bedridden. So in this instance, what this is telling me is that, all right, she's not taking her long-acting because of the nausea and vomiting as a potential side effect. But then what is happening then is her pain is uncontrolled, so she's suffering. She's suffering to a point where the pain is so severe that she's bedridden. Her pain is in her low back. It's also in her right cheek. She recently experienced a fall 2 months ago while trying to move a table. So this reminds me of my grandma. Leave me alone, I can do it. I can move a table. So this is something where that overwhelming sense of being independent, I call it fiercely independent. In this case, I'm getting that sense from her. So intentional non-adherence, what it is, it's a conscious decision to skip a dose, to stop taking a medicine, or to not even start it. What do we know about it? Well, in a study in patients who had chronic illnesses, a third of those patients did not take medications as prescribed, and out of this third, out of this subgroup, half of them, the time was deliberate, so that was intentional. What was the most common reason? Experiencing a side effect or the worry of I will experience a side effect in the future, so a potential for a side effect. Others were fears, so fears of experiencing a side effect and a belief that the medication is not working. So here's a list of known medications who are at high risk for intentional non-adherence. So this is known. ACE inhibitors, so again, these are drugs you commonly see for the treatment of high blood pressure or as well as heart failure and other disease states. Beta blockers, along the same lines, again, for high blood pressure, heart failure. Calcium channel blockers. So these are not individual drugs, if you will. These are classes of drugs. So within each name here, these involve numerous types of drugs. Calcium channel blockers. Diuretics. So diuretics includes furosemide that we saw earlier, or Lasix. bronchodilators, so that includes the examples shown earlier with regards to albuterol. Benzodiazepines, so some examples of those are Valium or diazepam. Ativan, or also known as lorazepam, Klonopin. So these are known classes of medications that are at high risk for intentional non-adherence. So one of the things that I often experience when I'm in the pain and palliative care clinic is that when I'm in a situation where patients are not taking their pain medicines, I really want to dig a little deeper. It's usually there's something more behind that in terms of not of a side effect. It may not be just the nausea and vomiting. It could be something else. And what I mean by that is trying to really look at what are the beliefs and fears and experiences that could be affecting her morphine use. I often will get the comment from patients with the belief that my pain is a sign of worsening of my disease. So remember, LL has colon cancer or is being diagnosed with colon cancer. So I often get the question, am I dying? Or there's the fear of addiction. So you know, it's in the news. It's in the newspaper. There are higher rates of opioid, so morphine is an opioid, of misuse and abuse. So there's this fear of addiction. What experience could be affecting her morphine use? So I often get the comments, I hear about this on the news all the time. I often will ask, is there a personal experience or an experience with a loved one, a friend, or a family member that concerns you in terms of concerns of their morphine use? And often the answer is yes. I have a best friend of mine that I saw her taking it, and she took it for a long time, and there were some things that I didn't like. I didn't like what I saw. So again, trying to understand and identify beliefs and fears, experiences, as well as the side effects that could be affecting morphine use. So some of the things that one can do as a clinician, and I often tell this to students, to the pharmacy students, to the medical students that often rotate through in the clinic that I'm in, is to acknowledge their concerns. Too many times, our new learners will, a patient will say something to that regard, and I don't know if it catches them off guard, or they're not sure what to say or what to respond, so they just gloss over it. They go to the next question. So it's important to acknowledge. Don't ignore it, and avoid placing judgment. Explore with patients their concerns for not taking the medicine. Discuss the benefits, so I call it the risk versus benefit, or the advantages and disadvantages of the medicine as prescribed, and provide positive reinforcement. I think if we think about the case, one of the things that we know clinically from morphine use as well as opioid use is that nausea and vomiting is a side effect that is common. It does happen, but it's transient. So over time, the nausea and vomiting, for the most part, will go away. If it doesn't, we do have means of treating with an anti-emetic or anti-nausea medication that the patient can take with each dose of morphine. And we found that that helps really decrease the nausea and vomiting associated with that. So creating a plan and then revising a regimen to potential, if the side effects continue, in an effort to decrease or avoid them. All right, so lastly, lack of continued healthcare professional monitoring. And what do I mean by that? What are things that we can do, or at least ways in the literature that are being done to assess medication adherence? So some of the research, or at least publications that have examined medication adherence, have looked at under and overuse of medication. They'll do pill counts or pharmacy refill records. Other ways to assess, again, you're always wanting to assess side effects. Even though you've been taking a medicine for months, years, you always want to assess in terms of are you experiencing a side effect from that medicine? Monitoring parameters for specific medications. So what I mean by that is the earlier example with warfarin or Coumadin. A lot of the for those that are on it or whatnot, you need to do a blood laboratory test to check your INR. And so there are monitoring parameters for that. Now what we'll do is highlight the Beers criteria, so medication appropriateness, in the next several slides. So what's really neat is that they're updated this year. So they were last updated in 2013, so they're now updated. I think they came out in probably the early part, April of this year. And so what it is, again, updated in 2015, the Beers criteria is a tool, if you will, to help identify potentially So potentially inappropriate medications that should be avoided in many older adults. It's also in an effort to reduce side effects or adverse drug events and drug-related problems and to improve selection and use in the older adult. It can be done in any clinical setting. So regardless of the specialist you're seeing, regardless of if it's for short-term use or long-term use of a medicine, it's designed to help in that manner, and it can be used in a variety of endeavors, from research to education to some quality improvement. So, and what I'll do is at the end, I'll have a website that will have a link where you can go and get information from what I'm about to present. So if there's a need to want to get this information, or if I don't put up that slide, please remind me after the talk. I'm happy to repost it so you can at least get get that website where all of this information is where it was obtained from. So AGS, or the American Geriatric Society, created a work group to encourage the use of Beer's criteria. And what the work group developed was what was known as the 7 key principles to help use or guide optimal use of the Beer's criteria. And it's guidance for how clinicians and others can apply these principles in practice. So what are these principles? I'm not going to highlight every one of them, but I do want to highlight ones that are applicable for you. Before we get into that, I think we have to have a perspective in our approach to the Beer's criteria, and it's using clinical common sense. What I mean by that is these are potentially inappropriate. They're not absolute. So often what I see is that patients will see, oh my gosh, I'm taking a drug that's on the Beer's criteria, so I need to stop it. And I always want to say, time out. It's potentially inappropriate. It really depends on the scenario that individual is in and their reasons for why they're taking it. Because at times, really, the benefit may be greater than their risk. But in other cases, the risk may be greater than the benefit. So in that scenario, then one could imagine, all right, we need to have a plan to either slowly decrease the dose or to actually stop that drug altogether. But again, it really depends. It's going to be very different for each of you. It's very individualized because it's really based on the scenario that we're in. And we'll have some examples of what I mean by that a little bit later. So the first principle, again, being redundant potentially does not mean it's definitely inappropriate. So, what we mean by inappropriate is that the balance between harm and benefit may be unfavorable for many older adults. But again, they're not a definite, so it really depends on the situation. So here's the list. It's not a complete list because it would be several slides. But there is something that you can grab from that website known as 10 medications that the older adult should generally avoid. So I've put them here. Again, with the context that if you see some of these medicines that you're on, I don't want an overreaction. I don't want it where, oh my gosh, I need to stop it right away. Now, what it means is, all right, if I'm on this, all right, I need to have a discussion with my provider or my pharmacist. Why am I on it? What is this for? My medicine was on the Beer's criteria. What do I do? So again, having a conversation and then coming up with a plan. So the medications that have been listed as part of the Beer's criteria, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or NSAIDs. So these include ibuprofen, Advil or Motrin, aspirin, digoxin, some diabetes medicines that we see here, glyburide and diabetes, some muscle relaxants such as cyclobenzaprin and Soma, benzodiazepines, Valium and Xanax. This is a tricyclic antidepressant, Elavil or amitriptyline. This is a very old medicine for pain. It's in an opioid class called meperidine or Demerol. And then we have an over-the-counter agent, Benadryl. And then we have Haldol and estrogen pill and patches. So I have yes. So the question is does this list give any hint of a prioritization? Yeah. And the answer is no. It was just done where just based on how they're listed has no bearing in terms of the the strength. They all need to be of concern. So what the Beer's criteria does is not only does it list these medications, but it gives you reasons why. And then it also provides alternatives. So I really like that, because a lot of times it's easy to verbalize, all right, don't do this, don't do that, or be careful with this. But then often what's missed is, well, then what do I do? What's an alternative? And so Beer's criteria has that ability where they've provided these medicines, they've given the reason why, and then they have an alternative. And so we'll get to some of that in the next slide. So in terms of the reason, so I didn't want to highlight all of the drugs, but what is in the Beer's criteria? So with regards to NSAIDs, it's the idea is to avoid long-term use. Alternatives exist to treat pain that are safer, so acetaminophen or Tylenol. I often get the question, well, I'm on a baby aspirin. I take that for my heart. Do I need to stop that? So again, that's a great question. That's a great statement and observation, because in that scenario, the use of baby aspirin to help prevent a secondary heart attack is much higher, that benefit, than the potential for this being on the Beer's criteria. So what I mean by that is, if they're on a baby aspirin, I would advise them to continue to take it, because you're really not taking it for pain, you're taking it for prevention of a second heart attack. What we're referring to here is if you're using NSAIDs on a long-term basis at a much higher dose and you're using it for a specific type of pain. Does that make sense? Same drug, but different scenario. Baby aspirin for the heart versus here it's really an aspirin. We're using higher doses for pain. You can see how the scenario is different, but it's still aspirin. And also primary prevent. Yeah, so the comment was, there is data to help to support that it helps in reducing the risk of a first heart attack, but it also helps in the event where you've had a heart attack, it reduces your risk of having that second one. So why Benadryl? Why is Benadryl on the list? Well, what we know about Benadryl is that it can knock you out, can cause some confusion, some oversedation, but it can also dry you up. So meaning dry mouth and constipation. So in the context where if I'm using Benadryl or I need something for a runny nose or I have allergies, there are alternatives you can use. So what we have here, saline nasal spray if you have a runny nose, but really to avoid Benadryl because of what we know where there's a higher rate of these side effects in the older adult. Now let me give you another situation where Benadryl would be appropriate. So at the Morris Cancer Center where I work at, we have patients that before getting chemotherapy, they get a pre-medication treatment, which includes Benadryl, and that's to help minimize the potential for a reaction to the chemotherapy. And you can tell in that scenario, since it's not all the time, it's just a one time before chemo, that in that case, you would want to give the Benadryl. So do you see how same drug, but the situation is completely different? So understanding why the medications are included and adjust the approach is another principle. In essence, what we're trying to do is we're trying to individualize the decision-making and finding out what works best for you. One of the things that we often overlook in clinical practice is that alternatives not only include another drug, but it can include lifestyle changes, education, so things that are often or can be missed because I think we're a society that often we're a consumer of pills. We're a consumer of medications in our society. So often what you'll see, if one doesn't work, let's try another. But sometimes if we take a step back and say, well, there are other things that we can do from a non-pharmacologic or non-drug basis that could be just as valuable. We need to be aware of that. What the Beer's criteria hopes to do is that it hopes to start a discussion. So often what we see is, I can just visualize, this past week being in clinic, if you can imagine, you're a patient, you check in, they give you a printout of all the medicines you're on, and it's a cursory look and check box it and yes, no. And I often see then when we go in, or when I see providers go in, it's often assumed, all right, this is your medication profile, all right, we're done. But there's so much more to that. There's so much more behind the story. versus if you stopped it, why did you stop it? If you changed the dose, why was that? Did somebody tell you? Did a provider tell you? Or was it something where you had a side effect? So there's a lot. I think you can get a good story by really looking and thinking about when you see a patient or when I see a patient and I see changes to their medication profile, I want to know why. Dig a little deeper. There are some other principles here as it relates to health insurance plans and how the criteria were primarily driven from a U.S. perspective. So I alluded to earlier, really the key thing from these principles is we want you to be empowered. Have a discussion with your provider, with your doctor, with your pharmacist in terms of, all right, I'm on these medicines, and one of them is on the Beers criteria. Is there an alternative? What do I do? I often get the question, you know, I looked this up on the internet. I'm taking this medicine, which is, I think, a great first step. So you want to know what you're taking. But then the next question I get is, well, I wasn't sure if this is the right resource or what's the best resource. Because I do tell patients where Googling a drug name, you have to be wary about it. Because there are blogs out there now, and there's a lot of opinion that can be out there that one can read. So this is one reference. It's the National Library of Medicine, and it's a drug information resource. And it's presented in a format that's digestible. It's very digestible, meaning it isn't that fine print in a drug label that, you know, is 5 pages and can be really confusing. So here's a resource that you can use for drug information. And I alluded to this earlier. What do I do if I'm taking a medication that is listed in the Beers criteria? It's okay to remind your doctor or pharmacist that the drug is listed. Ask about alternative medications. Never stop taking the medication without first speaking to your healthcare provider. And then, again, the questions to ask. Why am I taking it? How will I know it's working? When do I take it? And what should I look out for in terms of side effects? Another component of the Beers criteria is that there is an information with regards to how can I minimize or avoid over-medicating and the potential for harmful drug reactions. Ask before taking an over-the-counter medication. Secondly, again, I alluded to this earlier, making a list of all the medications you have with regards to the name, the dose, how often you take it. And you share that list with all of your healthcare providers. And have some type of consistent review, you know, yearly basis of your medicines, because they can change. Medicines, including your supplements, your vitamins, and over-the-counter agents. Avoid medication that is not prescribed for you. This seems pretty straightforward, but it does happen. In outreach events that I attend with our pharmacy students, we often go to many senior center, older adult housing facilities to give educational talks. And often, at most of the talks, we're getting, you know, comments, well, I can't afford it, so I'm taking something that my friend's no longer taking or my neighbor's no longer taking, and it works. And it happens. I mean, I have the same reaction. I laugh, but it's like a nervous laugh. I laugh because it's like, okay, but it does cause me some angst. And then avoiding alcohol when you take medication for pain, sleep. Basically, drugs that can also cause sedation. By taking the alcohol at the same time, you get an additive effect. So here are the resources. The website, geriatricscareonline.org. So that's where I got most of the information that you just saw, or a portion of my talk. They have information where we alluded to it earlier, 10 medications older adults should avoid. We highlighted avoiding over-medication and harmful drug reactions, so that's also there. What to do and what to ask if a medication you take is listed in the Beers criteria. And then there's some resources with regards to a diary that may be of help if you're needing to track in terms of the medicines you're on. So geriatricscareonline.org. Here it is again. And it's got Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn handles, which is pretty neat. All right, so to summarize this talk, what do we know about known risk factors for medication non-adherence? One is we know age, we know the isolated older adult, polypharmacy, and polyphysician are risk factors for medication non-adherence. The reasons for non-adherence include medication knowledge, challenges with regards to physical ability, cognitive capacity, and intentional non-adherence. Some of the interventions for medication non-adherence revolve around education with redundancy, so repeat of specific information. And then lastly, Beer's criteria helps to identify medication or drug classes that, again, are potentially, so not absolute, but potentially inappropriate for use in the older adult. So that concludes my talk. I'm happy to take any questions. So the comment or observation is, how do we get the system to work for us? How do we get the system to work for us? And the example you brought up is with regards to a medicine you're on that seems to do very well for you, and you had no problem getting it up front, but now it seems like over time, the paid piper. So, and that, you know, it's independent of the disease, it's independent of the medication. I get stories with regards to that all the time for branded drugs. So branded drugs, what that means is there's no generic available.
And there isn't.
They primarily have that company, whoever makes it, has the exclusivity period, meaning I only make it, or they only make it, and they have the ability where, unfortunately, in the United States, as we know, drug pricing is not as tightly regulated as it is in other countries. So the example is, who is that guy that's the most hated man in America for bumping up that rarely used cancer drug, I think by 4,000% or something like that? So, but what it's telling you is, again, the drug pricing is not as regulated in the United States, and that impacts all of us as patients.
You don't see that on your non-compliance.
Right. Yeah, I had it on my second slide. What's the reason for, what are the challenges for how you take your medicine? So cost, insurance. So that, I like it. You're observant. I like it. That's right. You're always the front row. But you're right. It is something, again, I'm not discounting it, but it is a huge issue, if you will, in terms of cost and affordability.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.